You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Nicholas Walker. Welcome, Nicholas. It's good to have you here this morning.
Thanks for having me.
So the way the show starts is, who are you? You know, and we start with a big question just so you can help us to start to get to know you. This conversation is how we get to know each other.
Okay. It's funny, I answer this question in a lot of different capacities because I'm a musician. So one of the things I am is a musician. And so you often have to, you know, put together a bio or introduce yourself to somebody you want to collaborate with or do some kind of a radio show or right. or something like this. So there's sort of spiels that you have about who you are.
Right. And they generally consist of labels.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Right.
But it doesn't feel like that's right here. So, I'm a teacher and a student. Mm-hmm. I play the double bass, and it's sort of like I see it as a sort of a lifelong Zen practice, uh-huh, you know? Uh-huh. And so I'm ever a student, and I also teach at Ithaca College, and I'm a father and a husband and a son and mm-hmm. a friend and all of those things too.
And in terms of the quality that you aspire to in your life, which is another way that's not big labels or personal labels, but what are the qualities that you aspire to have in your life or to promote in your being? You said you're a Zen, you have like a Zen relationship with your double bass, but also imagine with life.
I think a certain, especially at this stage of my life, a certain straightforwardness. Mm-hmm. I want to own my own stuff. Mm-hmm. And sort of, I don't want to tap dance and make a big show about it all.
Right. Right. And I would imagine that as a performer, it's tempting to get caught up in the outside shell or the image of the life of a performer rather than living from the core.
Yeah. I mean, it's what as a performer, when it's time to turn it on, you have to be able to turn it on. And
right.
So, you know, there's a difference between doing that on stage. Mm-hmm. Or in a recording studio or something, and doing it when you're having a conversation with somebody.
Right. You know?
So, I think maybe looking to just be able to surf those two domains more skillfully in my life, you know, is what I'm aspiring.
Sure.
To do. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. Well, you brought some music with you, and some of this is your own music. I mean, all of this is your own music. What would you like to go to start?
Sure. Actually, I'm a little bit shy about that because when you first sent the information about this, I thought, okay, so he's going to ask me these questions and he wants my music, because I was thinking about it from the perspective of just being a musician of course you would be asking me for my music, but I've recently been listening to your all of these archived versions. Well, not all of them, but I've been dropping the needle on a bunch of them.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And I realize there's just so many fascinating people from so many walks of life. And also, I have to say, I think you're really great at this. I find that I love the concept of sort of getting to know our community and ourselves and our world through conversations with people. And one of the things I noticed in all of those places where I dropped the needle was there's invariably some moment where you'll say to the person you're working with, so maybe another way of saying that is blank and blank, or I see a connection between this and that. And then the person will say, wow, yeah, that's it. I never,
or sometimes. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to this. So
thank you.
Let's see. Maybe the place to start is with that meditation from Thais. This is sort of a typical, what do you call it? Classical music piece. It's from Jules Massenet's opera Thais, and there's a violin feature, which I've made a transcription of for the double bass. And I love how the double bass can sing, and I like how it feels to hear hear a string instrument in this tessitura and in this way. This is with Nick Weiser, local. He's the music director at St. Paul's Methodist Church. He's playing piano. And we recorded this at Ithaca College with Al Grinwell from Finger Lakes Recording, did the recording for us. And
okay, hope you like it. Okay, so here we go. Thank you. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Nicholas Walker. So, wow, that's a beautiful piece.
Yeah.
I can see why you wanted us to listen to it.
Well, one of the things that is true is that I really love the bass. I really love mm-hmm. the double bass. Mm-hmm. And so that's definitely one of the things I aspire to do, is to show the world how gorgeous this instrument is and how it can sing and all right. the things it can do and mm-hmm. all the ways it can make people feel. And right. so I hope I can do that with the music that I'm playing, you know.
And for me, what I sense is not just the instrument, but the affection with which you embrace it, and how that is a skill that is it's a greater love, as you're saying.
It can be a great tool in performance to get the ego out of the uh-huh. out of the performance, because you can show people how the bass is beautiful.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah.
And not, or the music is beautiful, mm-hmm. or you know, other abstract things, but not look how I can play beautifully.
Right. No, I get it. Yeah. I get it.
You know, it's funny. You talked about the intimacy. I was thinking. There was a movie when I was a little boy called The Black Stallion, and it's a really beautiful film. Mm-hmm. I think it was.
It's a classic children's book, and it was made in. It's been made into a movie, I think, a few times. But
yeah. Yes, but this first version with it was, you know, it's a. It's really a work of art, and mm-hmm. I've watched it a lot of times since then. But it's this little boy who has to tame this huge wild animal. You know, there's like 20 minutes of the film with no speaking. You know, and the music is just gorgeous. Mm-hmm. It's and I feel like the bass maybe is like that for me.
For you. How old were you when you saw that film the first time?
I think I was maybe 13, like the age of the boy. Uh-huh. In the book, and I remember that there were, aside from the red hair, there was a lot of we looked.
You identified with the boy,
yeah, somehow,
yeah. One of the questions that we start after the first song often with is, you know, what experience has helped to shape your life, and you've kind of naturally gone into that. Well, how has that movie or how has that experience opened yourself up so you can discover? I mean, when you're 13, it's the age at which you're really trying to figure out who you are in the world for the first serious time. And we do it a lot over the course of a life. But how has that set the process of discovery and engagement for you?
The movie or the...
Well, the movie or the experience that you have had that's kind of grown, or where the movie has walked. You've described watching it many times. You describe how it had an effect. So somehow it's in a parallel or you're walking with it.
I think it was largely about finding music at that at that time in my life. And you know, I wasn't particularly good at music or gifted at all, but I just fell in love with it so much, and it opened up all these doors to me. You know. Mm-hmm. It opened up the ability to sort of connect with my stepfather, who was a jazz pianist, and I wasn't really able to connect with
in other ways.
Right. It gave me a sense of self in my school and with my friends. I mean, we used to have garage bands and put together things and, you know, summer camps. And I just fell really deeply in love with jazz music and the spontaneity and the improvisation and just this noble art of, it seemed there's just, still seems to me, there's just endless depth of human expression and vitality in that art form. And so all that was sort of happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. And also there is something, the double bass is so, it's a large instrument. And so when you're small and you're standing with it, there's this little, how do you do that is less about what's happening in your fingertips than the sort of an all-encompassing body experience.
It's your stance. Yeah. It's your embrace. It's the whole bit.
It's like a sport, you know?
It's a full-contact body sport.
Yeah.
Oh, I want to go back just a second. You said that you weren't really good at it. And what were the things that you thought you were good at that kind of went to the side as you began to embrace music?
How did
you transition from quote not being good at to being, in a certain sense, in love with it or deeply committed to it?
I think that those two things were sort of mutually exclusive. Like on the one hand, if I had a talent, I think it was just an enthusiasm and an energy, and a willingness to step into environments where I didn't know how or what to do. Like, I've done a lot of, you know, sort of fake it till you make it kind of things in my life. And I think I moved to a bunch of different houses and had, you know, different experiences and different really disparate groups of people as a little kid. And so I sort of developed a comfort level and process learning.
Right.
And just understanding that I can throw more energy into this and that I can trust that it will yield fruits. But I wouldn't say that's negligible or something like that. That was the kind of enthusiasm I brought, and I think I still bring to everything I do.
And another way of saying that is that you were not afraid of failure because the excitement about what you might do was more important than whether or not it worked out.
Yeah, that may be true. I mean, I think the moments of failure did sting.
Uh-huh. Oh, no, it doesn't make them not sting. But when you have that attitude, failure doesn't leave you in a puddle of shame.
Yeah.
If you're left in a puddle of shame, you don't get back up. And it usually is a sign that something about you was disfigured or lost mm-hmm. in the failure. Whereas the failure where you aren't shamed, you can learn from. And that's one of the definitions of, you know, you want to fail enough that you feel the sting, but you don't want to fail so much that you shut down. Learning happens in that wide band of experience. And it seems like you've discovered that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. And yeah, I really don't, I was not shamed for my failures. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is that, is, I would imagine you were saying this is how you connected with your stepdad. It's not every kid or everybody who can embrace the improvisational quality of jazz at times, or the incredible discipline demanded of playing it at a high level. So I would imagine that some level of respect was earned or exchanged in that process.
Yeah, I think there was. I think there was.
Yeah.
Gosh, I don't know what to say more about that. I think that those things are always in flux. You know, I did get, I think, pretty young. I think really largely through this instrument, through my relationship with this instrument, I did get the sense that, well, if you want to be able to do that, you need to be able to, you need to put in the time.
Right.
And that wasn't something that somebody told me. I mean, I'm sure lots of people told me that, but I didn't get it from what people were telling me. I got it from the visceral experiences at the instrument.
And we can tell it. I mean, I've told it to children, and you know, it goes in one ear and out the yeah. other ear if they're not truly motivated, and then they hear it and they have a sense that they have something to win.
Or how can I be a part of this?
Yeah, yeah,
how
yeah,
can
yeah.
like I can I feel this connection that's happening between
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
I think it's connection. It's all about connection with people. And the defining moments, you know, in my life are those moments of connection. I also remember being in a youth orchestra as a little mm-hmm. kid and playing at a retirement community for people who were really old, and we were supposed to play at a really fancy place, and we ended up playing at this retirement community. Instead, we were on a tour, a uh-huh, youth uh-huh. orchestra tour. And we played, you know, this adagio for strings, Barber adagio for strings, and it was just this life-altering experience. I just remember leaving that as an eighth grader and thinking, my God, how do I do this? How can I be part of this, you
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm.
Forever? And I remember being shocked as, you know, I don't know, I guess you're 14 or something in eighth grade?
Yeah.
As a 14-year-old to find at the end of that piece that I had been crying and the conductor was crying and mm-hmm, all mm-hmm. these, and not even realizing that I had been crying,
mm-hmm,
which
mm-hmm.
normally would be a mortifying thing to do as a 14-year-old in front of
yes.
a bunch of high school students. Yeah. They needed bass players, right? So another example of being, I was totally unqualified, but they needed bass players. So mm-hmm. I was able to join the group, and then I had these life-altering experiences. And mm-hmm. so then the question, well, how do I need more of this? I need, mm-hmm. this is the whole reason we,
right. And
drives me to do the discipline and
right,
the work.
Right. And it's a, it puts you on a, in a funny, agenda. You have experienced unselfconscious grace and discovered that you were in tears about something that was so powerful to you that you didn't know it until after you were done. You want that kind of experience, but you can't grab it too much, or you it becomes self-conscious, and you can't not do the work because you don't get the skill to reproduce it.
And you can't be you're not invited in.
Right.
The door.
Yeah, in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The skill is absolutely, that's the personal side, and the other side is, wow, once you have these skills, now people invite you to be a part of things that are special,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to fake it till you make it in those situations.
Yeah, you have to fake it. I mean, I was part of a very tiny little high school, a little school in Missouri. We had our graduating classes were 40 students. And in order to field a marching band, we had to bring the junior high students in so we would have enough bodies on the field. But we also had a regional winning marching band and a regional winning concert band and a regional winning jazz band. And I wanted to be part of that. And I started out with the trumpet and the French horn, but I have a lip that has a sensitivity on it that quivers that I cannot control when I'm playing music that's emotional. I lose the ability to control my lip. So I had to give those instruments up, and I kind of and we had kind of an imperious instructor, a little bit like the drummer in Whiplash. He didn't have the damning edge. He just had the high expectations.
Yeah.
And he didn't use shame so much as he just used, oh, no, that just didn't make it.
Yeah.
You know, and it brought out of us a level of performance that we were in competitions that were way beyond us. And we were young and yet we felt like we were part of a whole. Being part of an ensemble or an orchestra or whatever gives a person a chance to learn how to be in relationship in a way that a lot of people don't learn these days. I'm wondering if you have thought about how playing as part of an ensemble has changed or affected who you are or how you think about just being in the world.
Oh, absolutely. And the way I have been in the world has changed how I play in an ensemble.
So take it both ways.
Yeah, it's a great exchange. So, I can give you a recent example, and maybe it would lead to something here,
sure.
Which is that lately I've been playing with a fantastic singer-songwriter from Ithaca area. Well, he's from Tennessee. His name is Tenzin Chopak, and he's the leader of Rockwood Ferry. A lot of people, I think, would know him through that, but in October, we started playing together. We had we just had a real affinity. One of my former students had played with him, so I had heard him play before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd sort of been, I felt that I was drawn to something, some kind of new way of musicking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not that this is new. I've worked with singer-songwriters before, but something about it was alluring to me. And I reached out to a couple other people in town. Anyway, we saw each other and said, why don't you come over and we'll play? So we came over and it was like just sparks immediately.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we started getting together a lot. I mean, way more than probably my schedule or
your family commitments.
It was sort of out of proportion with the space that I would have mm-hmm, guessed mm-hmm. I had in my life. And we've been playing really a lot since then. And now, we actually, by the time this airs, I think we'll have already given our concert, but you can
sure.
check out stuff online. But there was one really interesting moment that happened early on in our collaboration that has affected this. So we were playing a piece, and there was this one moment in the piece where he plays an A chord, and I did this fill on the bass, dum dum dum, you know, and I thought it was a cool fill. But at the end of the piece, I have the rehearsal tape of it. You know, Tenzin said to me, he's a Buddhist and he's very generous and gentle and full of compassion. It's not never judgment, you know, from him. Uh-huh. But he says, well, I'm not entirely convinced about that one fill. Could you help me understand that? Or maybe we could come up with something else there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh yeah, okay. Maybe I just should play just an open A there. And he said, yeah, an open A would be great. And then I went into this space in my head. I was thinking, okay, I got to remember to play an A there. Like, I hope I don't show up on the bandstand in my exuberance, and then I just accidentally placed that fill, and I was thinking, what is it about that fill that's not, was it because I went up to the major six over an A chord, and he doesn't like that sort of sound, or what, you know?
Or is it too big for the space?
Yeah, or what is it? And I was thinking in all these kinds of paradigms.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then a little while after that, he started to tell me what the piece is about, which I hadn't entirely understood all of the lyrics at that stage of our interaction. And the song is about a shooter. It's about a Sandy Hook Columbine killer as a little boy.
Wow.
Before he does these horrible things, before he leads to this aggression and anger. So the song is meant to have this compassion for a will-be killer.
Yes.
Which is a very complex thing. And so the moment where I was playing that fill was right after he had said something like, "That's the way I will burn down your town. That's the way I will shoot the gun." And then I go, "Doom, doom, do." It's like right. the worst thing ever to play
yeah,
there.
Yeah, yeah.
But the thing that's interesting to me about it is that is not, is how I was, what my paradigms were for understanding this. I was in this place where I was thinking, oh, I have to remember to play an open A there. I don't have to ever remember that again in my right. life. Now yeah. I just am inside the song and I can't possibly play the wrong thing.
Right.
And the second thing was this idea about, is it a major six that's bothering him over it? Like, no, of course, it doesn't have anything to do with that. And then taking that paradigm, it, you know, and so then my job in this song is to somehow represent in certain points of the song, a kind of compassion to add weight to the song through the bass line at the beginning, maybe, and then to bring in a kind of compassion element or a yearning or a sadness mm-hmm. in for this person, and then to show his unraveling mm-hmm. through the kind of solo that I play. I mean, yeah. it's not like play something neat over B minor. It's like show this person really losing it. And right. so how do I bring... But it can't be just a kind of crazed lunacy. It's there's something directed and scary about the way that this is turning. And then I have to mm-hmm. move away from that to how sad this situation is mm-hmm. and to show this neglected person. And so, yeah, now I think about a lot of my music that way. What happens when I play Massenet, you know, the piece that we heard at the beginning of the yes. program, or, you know, Brandenburg 3, you know, what... What is the song about? What is the meaning that's being carried? And so this kind of collaboration has really changed how I approach music, and it's also changed what I bring, I think, how I'm thinking about interacting in conversations with people.
Right, right. And it sounds that you were not given a script, piece of music to play. Score is what the word I'm actually looking for.
Well, either. Because it can be scripted and without... Right, yeah, right. great words.
So... And what we as a culture are not doing well is, and what you lived through was you were playing it almost like by yourself, like toddlers. You were in a parallel play moment and one said, "That's not what I really want here or need here." And at some point we have to let go of that ego and learn to play well together. And when you don't have a score or a script, we have to learn how to respond to each other and to also honor the message that's bigger than any one of us as we put it out there together. That's what community is about as opposed to an organization. And that's what improvisation is more like community than and scored or scripted music is more like organization. And you it's powerful.
And the music itself has its own takes on its own yeah. life. It's like a child.
Yeah.
You know, I was you know, we had a long car trip together last night, Tenzin and I, and we were talking about how maybe it's like child rearing. Like my wife, you know, built the child in her belly and went right. through the pregnancy and the birthing mm-hmm. and that's sort of like maybe Tenzin will write the song mm-hmm. and he'll do all of those things. And I have a reverence for that. And, sympathy, but maybe not empathy. Like, I don't know what it's like to carry a child in my body. I don't know what it's like to birth a child. I don't know, but I can be there in support. But when the child is born, my role of parent and is in many ways the same as my wife, and that mm-hmm. the child now has mm-hmm. her own life, and we both are here to support it and give it what it needs. And in that way, it's not. That's how the egos disappear in healthy collaborations with music, because the music asks for its own thing.
Right.
And when there's not when we relinquish ownership of it, but not responsibility for it.
Right. Right. And I want to just describe a moment in acting where when you have come into the role, you can almost sit outside yourself and see the relationship develop, so you can make choices about it that you couldn't have made if you were too centered in yourself. And having being able to step out and take that perspective and be loving and demanding and forgiving all at the same time allows beauty and pain and sorrow and all the kinds of things that you're talking about in the song to happen without having to force them.
I like that. And also another level of that is it's actually your own life and personal experiences yes. that opened that door to you.
Right.
So right. it's like you're no longer yourself. I'm no longer myself, but my ability to understand or step into that role and for that role to take on its own universe.
It lives in me, but it is not me. And to be able to empathize with mass murderers, which I think on a certain level of spiritual maturity we need to be able to do, we have to know where it lives in us. Let's go to the song.
Okay.
And after we listen to it, let's just continue here if it's appropriate.
Yeah.
Tenzin Chopak and Nicholas Walker, Lost Time. Do you want to stay any more before we?
I'll just say that if anybody wants to hear this again, because I think it's worth hearing again, then it's on Vimeo. Right. You go to the Vimeo site and type in Tenzin and Nicholas, and you'll find this.
Right. And we'll remind you of that again afterwards.
Yeah.
The lies wander aimlessly. inside a never-ending moon. Follow the lullaby into your mouth, awoke inside a never-ending moon. Fluorescent lights from beautiful pills out of the hand of your soul. That's the way I will remember you as I walk away. That's the way I will shoot the time. That's the way I will shoot the time.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Nicholas Walker. Wow. That's the way I will shoot the gun, from having been a tender young lad to that's the way I will shoot the gun.
Yeah, medicated and neglected and left alone in front of an incandescent screen. And I don't know if that's the recipe for all.
No. It's that there are many different paths to that. I want to take up guns in a minute just for a slightliness from a slightly different point of view. Mm-hmm. But in the middle of that song where it's clear that the unraveling is happening, you're making sounds with a cello that we normally don't, I mean, with a double bass that we normally don't associate with the instrument. How do you make music out of terror?
I mean, that's the whole thing, you know. From a young age, I remember hearing about, you know, these just depictions of artists, you know, well, you just chip away the stone that's not the statue, it's easy to make a sculpture.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Or wow, there was this new texture that was that just had to be painted, so I painted it, you know. But sometimes in these songs with Tenzin in the great canon of Western classical culture, and those things are there. You have to be willing. I mean, it's risk taking, right? It's you have to be willing to fail, to chase after what's there and ask yourself, right, well, what is there? What does the song need?
Right. And where did you have to go in yourself? Or, you know, what was the movement as you discovered those screeching sounds? What do you remember how you stumbled on or ran to? I don't know what the process was for you.
Well, the thing that opened the door to me, interestingly, was a comment that Tenzin's wife made when she was listening to I forget, some iterate, one of our rehearsal tapes or something. But she said, she wants him to not let go of that one line, because otherwise you lose the compassion in the song, and we need to be like that. The whole song hinges on this. Yeah. And so when I found that I think just something about that comment made me feel like I could sort of bring a yearning sadness to it, and also a kind of rage. And then I think that the sun sets beneath the power lines, the electricity and just the desolateness.
You're playing the power lines.
Yeah. Something about that opened up some doors. And then it takes, I have to say, it's tempting to want to put all this stuff into words. But the great thing about instrumental music is that it's nonverbal. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though obviously I'm using the text of this composition in the linguistic meaning behind the song to expose this particular process, this same process can exist with purely instrumental music, and it can exist with a glance with my, you know, daughter when she gets off the bus. It can exist it's this magical moment that it's nonverbal that we can trust.
Well, yeah, and it's the difference between emotional communication that's direct as opposed to mediated by language. And
that's a good way to say it.
There's an emotional honesty to the combination of rage and
sorrow,
deep sorrow and sadness, because the two often go together. And when we're especially in the early stages of reaction to something, and we can get stuck in either one of them, but they go hand in hand, and being able to present them without judging them. And that doesn't mean that acts of terror are not worthy of judgment. It means we also have compassion.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing, right? It's like not, I like that, being able to observe them without judgment. I think another way that I like to think about that is not creating a big pathology about it all.
Yeah.
You know, well then that song is a this and it has to be a that. And it's like, now I'm living in the story that the song can't grow to become its next iteration.
You're living in somebody else's narrative, in somebody else's institution. And with pathology, we want to institutionalize the person and to make them sick or demented in a way that we cannot relate to them, and we don't have to relate to them, but the honesty compels us to have some compassion. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, thank you for bringing this.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anyway, Tenzin's a really great artist, and I'm learning a lot from him, and I'm also happy to become friends with him. You know,
it's, yeah.
I feel those two things going hand in hand too. So that's opening up another aspect of my life to have a friend who I really feel mm-hmm. close to. And
it sounds like it works with, a Melanesian prayer that says, God oil the hinges of my heart's door so that it may swing freely. Mm. And in a certain sense that your relationship sounds like it has that quality, and that's a really neat place to be in life.
Mm. Music opens that for both of us,
right? And what I'm curious about is how do you you're responding to him, but I imagine you're also a force for him to reckon with.
Yeah.
And how do you experience that side of the relationship?
Again, as long as we're both completely focused on raising this child, mm-hmm. the song or the mm-hmm. piece,
yeah.
with love and openness to whatever it becomes itself, then
it becomes and this and this and right. this and this and this, but not that.
Yeah, then no matter how much energy I bring to it, it's fine because it's in support of his goals, like another parent might bring that same kind of energy and unique and special perspective and gifts that the other parent maybe doesn't bring. Right. And so there's
and has
this
the honesty to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and it's just enough set in the life practice of understanding it, that that there's an essential trust there to raise this child. Yeah.
We've danced around this next question a little bit in different ways. But how have you changed in ways that you would not have known or chosen that have kind of proved to shape your life? How have you had to change in ways that you might not have chosen or even realized were important?
I guess, unless you ask very probing questions.
Can take them and you can say, well, let's not do that now. I mean, that's
no, fair. Yeah. It's fine. I think the thing that I've learned through, maturing and my midlife crisis and all the stuff that comes up, and, you know, I'm 43, so I've had at least one, maybe two now.
Uh-huh. Midlife comes at an earlier age. No, I'm teasing.
and I'm sure to have more down the road. But I think that my work is to sort of manage this almost ferocious energy and intensity with more skillfully. So I think I spend a lot of I spent more time being defensive of my energy and ideas, and I spent a lot less time intending to own my part in things. And now I'm a little bit more interested in that. It's not necessarily a bad, again, it's not a pathology. It's not a right. something. It's just what it's I bring.
Incredible
I bring
a, intensity.
I bring a lot of energy. Yeah, and intensity. Yeah. And so in my teaching, in my learning, in my, when I'm on a committee with somebody, when, and also one of the things we find out later is that we bring a lot of baggage, right? So I bring all this stuff into a, now at 43, I'm sometimes in leadership positions, president-elect of a big organization or chair of a committee or something. So it's like, well, I have to learn to deal with this baggage and with this ferocious intensity more skillfully. Mm-hmm. And so that's,
I know a little bit about what you're talking about.
I'm not able to articulate very well.
I'm going to tell a story which may open up pieces of it. When I was in college, I had such a righteous anger energy that people were afraid that they identified me with Victor Jara, who was killed in Chile after the, but he sang even as his fingers were broken and his hands were decimated. He continued to sing and to build the sense of oneness of the people who were there, even as he was being executed by the regime. And people saw that kind of intensity in me. And I even didn't get a job once because they were afraid I might get shot by some drug lords. And the thing is I really did have to learn how to live more, compassionately with myself and with others and more slowly, so that I did not burn out. And I'm 57 years old, and it took me another 20 years or 30 beyond that to really begin to take that lesson to heart. Mm-hmm. And what you're describing is a similar kind of intensity, maybe not with those kinds of fireworks, but it's you have to learn how to live with yourself and free that for whatever it's worth, and taking on other powers or beating up yourself or beating up institutions or whatever generally doesn't produce a productive person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's for sure. And it can also, when your job is to be a leader or or play the point person, then it can really get in the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where you are finding your way to dance into those roles, and I'm using the dance because that's a physical metaphor, and a lot of us who have high energy have to have our physical needs addressed in order to be able to be present.
Yeah, yeah, present. Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah,
that's the difference.
Yeah, one of the ways in which we close the show is to reflect on what you do, what the guests, what you, Nicholas, do on a daily, weekly, monthly, annual, whenever basis to help to restore you intellectually, emotionally, physically. When do you know you need to? What do you do? How did you come to learn it? Those kinds of questions.
Well, one thing I do is I play the bass. I mean, that's my that's my yoga practice. That's my oxygen mask. That's my, I typically do that before the day starts, especially when classes are in session. I'm teaching at Ithaca College. I get up really early. I go to bed early, but yeah. I get up really early.
So when do you go and when do you get up? I mean, what's early mean for you?
I get up by five.
Yeah.
And I practice for an hour and a half before I get the kids up. So one thing is play the bass. The other thing is connect with my children. That's something that I've had to learn to do, you know, with a absent father for some years and a largely absent stepfather. I didn't really have a lot of modeling of that. So them teaching me that and me teaching that I find that's hugely restorative. I get up and I play and I
and you play with your kids
and I play with, well, I get them off to school. I parent, you know, I'd like to play with them. Well, we have my 4-year-old, we have a tickle fest and, you know, I do music and games and reading with my 8-year-old and, she has a zillion ideas and, mm-hmm. And that's fun. And I'm the audience. I mean, that's one of the gifts that is given to me is people listening and attending to the music that I play when I perform. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge gift actually. And so I play that role, mm-hmm. With them, which is fun and, really fulfilling and mm-hmm. somehow hugely restorative to mm-hmm. me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, those are a couple things, a walk, you know, learning to take a walk when it's time.
So what are you saying when you say when it's time as your voice drops? And
yeah, just meaning, you know, life piles up and it's you're exhausted and it's just too much and your brain's going and you can't stop thinking and the thoughts are coming and I'm not being my best self and I just
so your mind is getting ahead of your body.
Yeah, maybe that's
you're racing. The thoughts are coming. That's what I'm hearing. I ask people what's the signal, and you're giving me some of the things that are the signals for you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the power of being able to observe myself and know that. Yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I've a bunch of people on your show have given much more cogent answers to this than I'm giving. But just a simple thing, being able to get outdoors. My wife is excellent at that. She's amazing. She runs every day. Uh-huh. She takes walks every day. You know, she's outside whenever she can be. And, you know, she's a great model for me and in self-care, being outdoors and the way that she eats and the way that she, just moves her body.
And so I've heard in your telling, a lot of the story of how you take care of your emotion and your body. How do you take care of your intellect? How do you, is it the reflection on things that are happening? Is it the learning how to turn it off when it goes too far or begins to work against you so you go take a walk or whatever?
Yeah, I guess that's a good question. I guess one of the ways that I did a lot more of this when I was, you know, getting my degrees and stuff I guess just reading and studying and thinking and presenting and being able to articulate complex arguments and stuff. Most of that comes through just adult conversations now with my wife is quite brilliant and really an amazing intellect. And uh-huh. so just sort of keeping up with her or attending to the stuff that's going through her mind on a daily basis is, I think, a good exercise regime for me. But a lot of times I'm actually working to get away from that in the music and in my teaching. I find that the students that I work with are almost always want to engage with an idea first through intellect. And mm-hmm. they don't really trust just observational learning or physiological learning mm-hmm. or aural learning mm-hmm. or experiential learning. They don't really have a paradigm for, they've been really taught that you have to understand it and then they think they're done. There's like, oh, right, I use this fingering. And it's not in their body. Mm-hmm. It's not in their aural memory. It's mm-hmm. not, doesn't reside. They haven't observed it. They don't. Whereas I think some of my greatest learning happened from observing my teachers and them asking me questions like, mm-hmm. why?
Or I don't want that little riff played there or filler played there because this is what the song is doing, which is an analysis, and you responded to it. You're also describing...
Well, that's also... I'll just interrupt for a second. Sure. I think the difference about that is when I tell you that story, that's me telling it retrospectively.
Right.
My experience in the moment didn't happen that way. And that's one of the things I try to be conscious of when I'm working with my students is that it's so easy to tell our story backwards, you know,
right.
This is the outliers, right. Malcolm Gladwell thing. Right. So when I was living it, what I thought was, oh, he doesn't like that. I have to remember, oh, why didn't he like that? And then suddenly he tells about what the song's about, and suddenly I start to feel free, and then I go with that feeling, and I don't really know what it means or where it will take me, and we don't know how the song's going to shape around it, but we're not really thinking about it very much.
So you're doing what you're teaching with Deepak. What I was really where I was headed with that and made a misstep was... There used to be this concept of visiting, and it's where you sit and you, or you stand or you walk, but you talk. And in visiting, it's a back and forth. It's analytical, it's emotional, it's physical posturing. It's what friends and families historically did when they didn't have devices to distract themselves or watch TV, or everybody facing the screen.
Right.
And you learn an art of repartee that is... at times it's pointed, at times it's silly, at times, and that exercises the mind and the body and the heart all at once. Mm-hmm. And we don't do that so much, but it sounds like you have that kind of sort of conversational respect for your spouse.
I do. We don't have TV in our house.
Yeah.
I mean, kids watch Netflix sometimes, but we don't have TV.
Bless you.
Thank you. There's a fair amount of texting and phone time,
and
a lot of articles through Facebook, you know, that kind of thing that get passed around in videos and this kind of thing. But yeah, there's a fair amount of real in the moment time that happens that I really like. I love that concept of visiting. I love how you said that.
Nicholas, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Oh, it's been great to get to know you. Thanks for having me be a part of this.
We're going to close with I Got It Bad. Do you want to say something about it?
Yeah, this is with the same pianist, Nick Weiser, who played with me earlier. He and Greg Evans, a local drummer, and I have a trio called 13 Degrees. It's spelled lowercase I with the number 3 and then a degree sign. We play at Argo's Inn every Wednesday from 5 to 7, and we've been there for a year and a half. And we're all about bringing music to the community and the community to music, and played at a prison and at a hospital and a homeless shelter and schools, and I hope you'll dig this. This was a spontaneous recording. I was borrowing the bass that belonged to Scott LaFaro, and I said, hey, check out how this thing sounds, and I started to play, and then they motioned to keep going, and they joined in.
Wow.
And you'll hear their entrance comes in sort of shockingly telepathically on an uninspected beat, and they play totally together.
Okay, here we go.
Thank you.